is Macro Voices with hedge fund manager Eric Townsend, the free weekly financial podcast targeting professional finance, high net worth individuals, family offices, and other sophisticated investors. Macro Voices is all about the brightest minds in the world of finance and macroeconomics telling it like it is, bullish or bearish, no holds barred. Now, here are your hosts, Eric Townsend and Patrick Serezna.
Macro Voices episode 58 was recorded April 13th, 2017. I'm Eric Townsend. Lance Roberts, executive editor of the super popular realinvestmentadvice.com blog, will be joining me as this week's featured interview guest. Lance put together a great book of charts and graphs for this interview, which you're not going to want to miss. Registered users at macrovoices.com already received the download link in your research roundup email. If you haven't registered yet, look for instructions on how to register a free account and get the download on our homepage at macrovoices.com right next to Lance's photo.
And I'm Patrick Serezna. Now, Eric, let's get into looking at the market outlook here. And I was just looking at the S&P 500, and just in like the last 20, 30 minutes, we saw it just continue selling hard. Right now, as we close on the day, it's looking at around 23, 25 on the S&P, on the futures. What's your feeling here on the S&P?
Well, clearly we've taken out the 50-day moving average to the downside. That's a significant technical signal. But again, in terms of the big picture, you know, what this feels to me is like the summer of 1999. And I remember that summer very well. I had just the year before sold my own software company. I knew that tech stocks were in a massive overvaluation bubble. And I wanted to short tech stocks in size in the summer of 99. And thankfully, I was talked out of it because, of course, what happened was I was exactly right that tech stocks were in an overvaluation bubble, that the valuations didn't make any sense. But what happened next is there was another 50% of upside over the next year before finally that blow off top occurred in 2000. So we don't know when this thing is over. Is it finally ended? Has this rally that has not made sense for the last few hundred S&P points finally come to an end? Has the Trump trade finally ended and we're seeing that with these technical breakdowns? Or is this just going to be another buy the dip moment? We don't know that. Morgan Stanley had a note out this week saying they expect a 30% upside from here in the final stages of the bull market before the top is finally in. Is that right or is it wrong? I don't know. They don't know. I don't think anybody knows. What I want to ask Lance Roberts in this feature interview, because he manages portfolios for a living. He runs a very highly respected advisory service with a lot of high net worth clients, is when do you decide that it's time to get out of the market or go short? Because I know he agrees with me that this market is overvalued, but at the same time, the trend is your friend and the trend has been up, and we haven't seen enough yet to indicate that a trend reversal is in play.
Well, let's take a look at that dollar index now. I mean, rejected at the 101 level, and now we're sitting right in the middle of that kind of range at 100.45. What's your thinking here on the dollar index?
Well, Donald Trump is clearly at it again. He wants a lower dollar. A lot of his policies are actually dollar bullish, but he knows that he needs a lower dollar. And his comments this week, I think, had a lot to do with triggering this last sell-off. And it's not just the dollar index taking a nosedive. It's also Treasury yields taking a nosedive on Donald Trump's comments. So I think that for now, it is all talk. But, you know, I'm glad to be sitting this dance out. I still have a bullish long-term view, or intermediate to long-term view on the dollar index. But in the short term, my conviction has been reduced.
All right, let's move on to crude oil, where this rally just continued all the way up above the 53 handle, and now it's just starting to show signs of slowing down. What's your thinking here on oil?
Well, the last 2 weeks have been gut-wrenching for the bears, needless to say. Syria was definitely a big part of it. And just to be clear, the oil production that might have occurred in Syria or been taken offline in Syria, that was never the issue. The reason that oil rallied on the Syria invasion that occurred just a few hours after we published last week's show was the risk, or the perceived risk, of an escalation to a broader, wider spread condition of war in the Middle East, not just in Syria. You know, frankly, this rally has also been driven so much by OPEC rhetoric. You know, it felt to me last week like if an OPEC minister farted that we were going to have the market rally on news of increased natural gas production. I mean, it was just crazy for a while. But, you know, I think maybe it's run out of steam because despite the fact that our friends at hashtag OOTT had a bearish forecast expecting a big build on crude oil inventories, we got modestly bullish data from EIA this week. The crude oil drawdown of 2.2 million barrels was much larger than analyst expectations. Cushing, Oklahoma saw a 276,000 barrel build. Now, that was, in fact, a build to all-time new highs, about 90% of operating capacity at Cushing, but offset by the nationwide drawdown of 2.2 million barrels. Gasoline saw a 3 million barrel drawdown. Distillates, a 2 million barrel drawdown. So, you know, 2.2 million on crude, another 3 million in gasoline, 2.2 in distillates. Those are pretty big drawdowns across the board. The only thing that was a build was Cushing, and it was a small build. So you would think that that would, especially in this environment where the market's just latching on to any potential sign of good news, to rally even higher. What we saw is a spike on that news to a higher print. It only lasted a couple of minutes, and then it rolled over. What I see is exactly the opposite of what I described 2 weeks ago, or maybe it was 3 weeks ago in this program, when we had first touched 47. And we saw that rejection of 47, and it looked like we'd reached an exhaustion condition because it was right after the inventory report. I thought it should have kept going down through 47 to even lower numbers than that. What happened is the selling was exhausted. Well, it looks like now maybe the buying is exhausted, and we're going to see this thing is over. Production was up 36,000 barrels, or about 0.4% in the United States. That, of course, should be bearish. A lot of people are saying that was what caused the price rollover. But frankly, I don't think that very small 0.4% increase in production, which was very easily predicted because you can tell from lagging the rig count that you know production is going to keep ticking up, I don't think that offsets the surprise in terms of across-the-board drawdowns on inventory as well as finished products, yet the market still rolled over and has been headed lower since that event. So I think it's finally out of steam. I think that it makes sense that it's out of steam because put this in perspective, Patrick. Think about what this is really all about. This rally, as far as I can tell, before Syria happened, it was all being fueled by this excitement about the OPEC cut continuation. Now, stop and think about what that means. They take something, a 1.8 million barrel cut in production that OPEC agreed to several months ago, that clearly and demonstrably through hard data has not worked at all. And the bullish euphoria is because they've decided to take what has not worked at all and keep doing the same thing for another 6 months. There's no reason for all this bullish euphoria. Sure, the Syria thing makes sense, but the rest of it has just been driven on OPEC hype. So in the absence of a further geopolitical escalation, of course, you know, North Korea sends a nuclear warhead our way, anything could happen. But barring a geopolitical escalation, I think maybe that this overdone rally is over, and I'm looking forward to potentially taking out first the 50 and then the 200-day moving averages to the downside. I say that's my prediction. Then again, I didn't think it was going to go nearly as high as it has. I suppose you could take the other view and say, hey, we're back to that 53 to 55 trading range that we were stuck in for quite a while, and I didn't think we were coming back to it. So who knows? I'll be very, very surprised, Patrick, if we get above 55 again here, but anything's possible.
Well, I have to share that view. You know, like one thing that I'm certainly looking from a technical perspective is that what kind of failed rallies we start to see. When I want to observe an oil is every time it rallies, if it starts showing those signs of active distribution, and then you can really start kind of seeing whether or not that big rollover occurs there. But, you know, I want to move on to gold here because what a breakout. That 1260 was such an important overhead resistance. And the moment gold broke that, it just took off. I mean, we're up now at the 1286 level. What's your thinking on gold here?
Well, obviously, I'm kicking myself for not following my own call and buying at 1125 right after the December rate cut. But what we've seen now is the price of gold has been bid up by geopolitical risks, Syria and then North Korea. You know, it could get worse, but statistically, the more likely outcome is that this blows over and North Korea does not, you know, nuke the United States, and we do not see a Russian-U.S. escalation as a result of the situation in Syria. So I'm not really anxious to buy it here. Technicians I'm watching are saying that a pullback to 1220 is likely in the cards before it moves higher. I certainly regret not buying 11-something. We get into low 1200s, maybe I'll start dipping my toe in the water. But at this point, I think it's already been pushed pretty hard by these geopolitical risks. And unless there's a geopolitical escalation, I think maybe a pullback is in the cards.
Yeah, there's probably a few more dollars on the upside. Maybe we even see 1300 or 1320, but it's probably going to have some sort of a throwback here. Let's also take a look at these bonds. I mean, literally the moment gold broke out, the yields on that 10-year gave out at the 230 level, and we've been heading lower on those yields since. What's your thinking here on the bonds?
Well, as you say, we traded today below 2.25, just as I predicted would happen. Donald Trump talking down the dollar had a secondary effect of talking down bond yields at the same time. What I want to see is how long that lasts. Is it just going to be a reaction to that jawboning, or are we on the way to a sub 2% bond yield? I'm very interested to see what happens next. I'm leaning towards yields continue to deteriorate. I did follow up with Juliette de Klerk after last week's interview. She's still very bullish on bonds, thinks that we're headed still towards lower yields.
Thanks for the market update, Eric. Before we go on to our featured interview, I have a couple of housekeeping announcements. Macro Voices will be published one day early next week, late Wednesday evening on April 19th to accommodate travel schedules. We'll return to our regular Thursday evening release schedule the following week. Lance Roberts is the chief editor of The Real Investment Advice and host of the Lance Roberts radio show. Eric will be appearing as a guest on Lance's show next Wednesday, and we'll provide you with information on how to access that podcast in next week's Research Roundup email when it's sent out late next Wednesday. Now, there's a chart book to accompany today's interview. If you do not have access to the chart book, the instructions are on macrovoices.com's website in the description for this podcast, right beside the picture of Lance. Eric's interview with Lance is coming up as Macro Voices continues right here at macrovoices.com.
And now, with this week's special guest, here's hedge fund manager Eric Townsend.
Joining me next on the program is Lance Roberts, CIO at Clarity Financial and executive editor of realinvestmentadvice.com. Lance, I really appreciate your coming on the program. I've been looking forward to this one, and I just want to acknowledge for our listeners something I really respect about your style is I talk to a lot of our guests about this phenomenon that, as far as I'm concerned, this whole bull market that we've seen since 2009 has really been driven by Fed liquidity. And I get lots of head nods and mm-hmms and so forth. Your case, you just go straight to, let's put together a chart book and talk about hard data, look at the charts and graphs. So I strongly recommend that our listeners download the book of charts that you sent us. And why don't we jump right into it and talk about this? Because I think you share my view that this whole bull market has really been driven by liquidity. But why don't we start with page 3 of the download? Talk us through this. What are we seeing here? And, you know, is there any reason to think anything other than central bank liquidity is what's been driving this bull market?
Well, you know, I don't want to – the answer to your question is yes. There's a big driver has been central bank liquidity, and, of course, from that, there's been some other inputs into that, which has certainly been beneficial to the extension of the bull market. But if we extract out the liquidity that was being brought in by the central banks and, of course, the QE program specifically – you know, what you'll see is that the S&P would be trading probably closer to 1,500 or 1,600 rather than 24 or 2,500. And that's the extent to which the Federal Reserve interventions have done by injecting liquidity through the system. But it's not been just the QE programs. There's also been a variety of other bailouts that have occurred along the way that have also helped fuel growth in terms of earnings. And again, there's a big differentiator between what's happened in the economy really since 2009. If we take a look at earnings growth, which is what happens at the bottom line of a balance sheet, that's grown by over about 230% during that nine-year period. That's in total, right? So if we go back to 2009 and look at earnings growth in total since that period of time, earnings growth at the bottom line has grown by about 230%. But revenue, what happens at the top line, has only grown by about 23 to 25%. So what's happening at the inside of balance sheets is because of the repeal of FASB Rule 157, which, by the way, is still repealed and allows banks to mark assets to fantasy values rather than having to mark them to fair market value. This has boosted earnings. This has created a lot of growth. Of course, wage cuts and cost reductions on and productivity increases by corporations, but tax write-offs, et cetera, have all gone down to the bottom line and created a push in earnings that really is not as real as you would think it would, as real as it sounds when you consider the slow growth in revenue that you've had at the top line.
Now, as far as where this is headed, a lot of people would say, you know, this bull market has gone so long, we're way long in the tooth on the business cycle. Mm-hmm. But the thing I look for is, okay, what's the catalyst that's going to change it? So is the Fed now talking about reducing the size of their balance sheet, shrinking it maybe beginning this year? Is that going to be the catalyst that brings a bear market, or what comes next? What do you see changing this picture?
You know, that's the question that I get the most often is well, Lance, you know, you're talking about the risk in the markets, and we've got these huge extensions of price over long-term means. So from a technical basis, we take a look at leverage within the system, whether it's margin debt or corporate debt versus equity. You know, whatever you look at, you're absolutely right. We're extremely long in the tooth in terms of this particular economic and business cycle, as well as market cycles, second longest bull market on record right now. So valuations at, you know, the top three highest levels of valuation all time, only broken by the abnormality of really what PEs were back in 2000, because so many companies didn't even have earnings at that point, the technology companies, and of course the peak in 1929. So you take a look at all those factors, you say, well, yeah, a bear market's obvious. You know, we're going to end this cycle. And the question, and to your question, the same question I always get is, well, Lance, what's going to cause that? What's going to be the thing that trips us up? Here's the answer. I don't know. And neither do you, and neither does anybody else, because the things that we do know that are going to be the problem. As an example, as we talk about currently today, right, we've got geopolitical risk all over the world. We're dropping tomahawks in the middle of Syria. We've got the Carl Vinson Carrier Group sitting off the coast of North Korea. We've got China rattling sabers in the South China Sea. That didn't cause a problem. The markets held up during all that for the most part. No real rattle there. When we take a look around, all these things that we think should be a problem don't seem to be a problem because the markets factor them in very quickly. Let's go back to 2008 for a moment and think about what happened in the financial crisis. In 2008, we had Bear Stearns early in 2008. Federal Reserve bailed them out. Didn't rattle the markets. In fact, markets went to new highs following that. And then we started kind of selling off in the early parts of June and July. We got a sell signal. I recommended then that people start getting out of the market, starting going to safety because, well, we had all the evidence that a potential correction was coming. Of course, at that point in time, Ben Bernanke was saying, hey, it's a Goldilocks economy. Don't worry about it. Everybody was bullish on the markets. This is just a temporary bump. We're all, buy the dip. We're all going to all-time highs. Well, nobody counted on the one thing that occurred in September of that year, which was when Lehman Brothers was forced into bankruptcy. See, it was a catalyst that nobody had counted on. It was something that was that nobody could factor into. Nobody had even thought about the risk of something like a Lehman being forced into bankruptcy that disrupted all the counterparty risk. But that's the moment where not only did we break the market, but we also started triggering this very nasty thing that we've got sitting out there once again, which is a record level of margin debt. See, the issue with margin debt, people go, well, margin debt's fine. It's no big deal. Don't worry. You know, it's nothing you should worry about. The problem with margin debt is that as long as it's going up, you're okay. I often equate it to, you know, basically dousing yourself in gasoline. You can douse yourself in gasoline, and it's not a problem. Just don't get close to a match. And the problem here is with margin debt is that as long as it's going up or stable, you're okay. But when prices begin to decline enough, that's when you begin to trigger margin calls. Margin calls induce more selling because you have to meet the margin call, which triggers more margin calls. And the next thing you know, you get a 1,000, 2,000-point plunge in the markets because of the impact of margin debt. Margin debt matters a lot once it's triggered. It's just not, it's not important now, and the markets aren't paying attention to it because there's no risk.
I want to push back on this subject of margin debt because, first of all, personally, I couldn't possibly agree more with you that this is a big risk. There's too much leverage in the system, and this is not going to end well. But as far as whether or not we're close to a tipping point, I think that a lot of people have written recently about reaching record highs in margin interest, in leverage. Mm-hmm. And I would argue it's not really a record high in leverage because it may be in dollar amount. It may be a record amount of debt. But we're also looking at a much higher market capitalization of the market overall. So in terms of percentage of the outstanding market capitalization, I don't think we're at a record in that sense. And that, to me, that's where the tipping point comes, is when people are over margin to the point where margin calls beget more selling and so on and so forth, and it becomes a vicious cycle. Mm-hmm. So how do you measure this if not in absolute dollars? Is there a percentage of total market capitalization that comes into play here?
Well, I recently wrote an article about, discussing leverage in the system and primarily focusing on margin debt. And you're absolutely right. In terms of margin debt as it relates to market capitalization levels, we're not nearly to the record that we saw previously. But what's important about margin debt is the acceleration of margin debt. And that's the thing I really look for. If you take a look back in 2000 and then again in 2007, what you saw there was a pickup in the acceleration in the rate of margin debt accumulation. We're starting to see some very early signs of that. We haven't gotten to the extremes that we saw previously back in 1999. But the important thing here is for me and the way I look at it, I don't disagree with you about the level of debt in terms of market cap, and I think that's a great way to look at it. But what I'm looking for, and again, to your point, is that I'm looking for the reversal in the direction. When margin debt begins to go in a negative manner and we start to see an unwinding of margin, we'll be able to see that fairly early on before it starts to become a real catalyst event. That's the thing. And so one thing I look at is the level of margin debt on average versus its 12-month moving average. And whenever the 12-month moving average is crossed, what you'll see is typically you've either seen a major market correction or at least like we saw in 2016, a correction in the market that between 10 and 20%. So that's historically been the norm. I think that's a great early indicator just to try to understand what margin debt's trying to tell you as a function of the market.
And what about the effect of interest rates on margin debt? Obviously, a lot of people are wooed into, hey, why not go out on margin? It's cheap. It costs almost nothing. And of course, I think that whether it's happening this year or next year, I'm not sure, but eventually we're getting to higher yields and higher margin interest rates. Does that historically act as a trigger that causes people to have to unwind their margin debt? Or do you think that we're fairly insensitive to interest rates in terms of what that catalyst will be to turn this trend around?
No, it's a good point. But when we go back in history, you know, what was the level of margin interest back in 1999 when we were borrowing money then? That was cheap relative to where it was, you know, 10 years earlier. Where were we in terms of margin interest debt levels, interest levels in 2007, 2008? It was cheaper than it was in 1999. And yes, you're absolutely cheaper than you are today than you were then. And you're absolutely right that we can borrow awfully cheaply, but therein lies the trap. Which is, you know, when we take a look at, when we start combining things like corporate debt, margin debt, and household balance sheet debt, right, credit card debt, you've got the highest level of debt indebtedness ever before in history. We're over $51 trillion in those three things combined. And so if you've noticed, I've excluded governmental debt out of that. We're just talking about the things that impact you and me and the economy directly and businesses. And the market. So margin debt, household debt, corporate leverage. You got $51 trillion in debt right now. That's the highest level in history. And yes, and a lot of that's been fostered by extremely low interest rates. But this has been a continuation since 1983. In 1983, we began this deregulation of the financial industry, and you could buy everything on a credit card cheap, and it was getting cheaper every single year. And as interest rates have continued to fall, we have continually adopted at living beyond our means in terms of our financial capabilities, because we could borrow it cheaper. Oh, I can't really afford it today, but hey, I can get it for 3% interest or 2% interest, or now I can finance a car for 0% down and 1% a month. You know, these are the type of things that have gotten us into the trap. But ultimately, debt is debt is debt is debt. And when you get into the position and we start unwinding this issue, and when we hit to the point in the markets where the markets began to trip and stumble and fall, and we lose that factor of wealth confidence, and when the wealth, when the confidence factor is lost, that's where, particularly when we're growing at, you know, 0.5% GDP in the first quarter, you don't have a lot of wiggle room between that and a recession, and then that's where the unwinding of debt becomes a problem. So, yes, interest rates are a factor that allow people to take on more debt, but don't forget at the end of the day, we have to service the debt, and ultimately at the end of the day, debt has always been the culprit of a major unwinding of both the economy and the markets.
And I would point out as well for our listeners that got the download, you've got a fantastic chart on page 8 that shows us, even in contrast to 1999 or 2007, we're still looking at a higher margin debt level right now as a percentage of real GDP.
That's right. That's absolutely correct.
Let's go back to the 2008 crisis. A lot of people have different views of this, Lance. I look at this as we never solved the real problem, which was too much total debt. What we've done with central bank liquidity is to paper over our problems by addressing the symptoms rather than the real cause. And a view that I've held for several years is when the shit really hits the fan here is when we get to another crisis, but we have a macro backdrop that's inflation as opposed to deflation. Because at that point, the central bankers' hands are tied. They can't just print money to print their way out of a problem, because that would exacerbate the inflation. Now, we're a long ways from that. I'm curious, would you agree with that view, that that's where the big risk eventually comes in? And how far off do you think that might be?
So the two things that come in, when the Fed, when we talk about the Fed printing money, okay, so that's there's two views about that. First of all, are we talking about printing actual currency, or are we talking about printing digital currency in terms of doing quantitative easing? And the reason there's a difference to that is that what the Fed did in 2009, 10, 11, 12, 13 is we were printing digital currency. In other words, we were crediting bank reserves to provide liquidity in the system, pulling bonds out of the banking system, giving the banking system liquidity in which they could go leverage the Japanese yen against the U.S. dollar and then go trade proprietary assets and whatever it is, right? So that's how they fueled the financial markets. Ben Bernanke even came out in 2010 and says, hey, look, we are trying to lift asset prices. That boosts consumer confidence. That should translate into higher economic growth. Unfortunately, it never quite worked out that way. We got a big boom in the stock market for 20% of the population that actually have money invested in the stock market. For the other 80% of the population, they didn't benefit from it at all, and that's why 80% of the population has $500 in the bank and no savings. So it didn't really filter through the economy like the Fed thought it would, but basically acted as a giant wealth transfer from the middle class to the wealthy. That's a different argument for a different day. But to your question specifically, when we go back and look, is that the Federal Reserve can only buy the bonds that are issued from the Treasury. So if we get into an environment, and I don't think this is going to be the case, I think the Fed is going to have plenty of room to do this, is that as the deficit shrinks, and as we move from the $1 trillion deficit back towards $400 billion under Obama's last couple of years in office, the amount of treasuries that were being issued in order to what could be used for purchase for quantitative easing was being shrunk. So the ability to do bigger and bigger rounds of QE and an unending availability of doing QE is becoming much more difficult. Here's my point about this. There is only a finite ability of the Federal Reserve to buy bonds in order to liquefy the markets through quantitative easing programs. They cannot absorb the entire bond market, because then you won't have a bond market. It'll all be held at the Fed. So there is a point to where quantitative easing not only loses efficacy, but it also becomes a financial risk by absorbing too much of the bond issuance out of the financial markets and into the hands of the Fed. And I think this is one thing that you're going to see not only here domestically, but globally as well. The European Central Bank, Bank of Japan, and others that have engaged in this type of issue of buying bonds out of the system. And this is why you're seeing them shift to buying equities. One of the problems for the Federal Reserve is that they are only allowed by congressional mandate to buy bonds or buy instruments that are of credit and are guaranteed by the government. So in other words, they have to be Ginnie Mae's or U.S. Treasuries. They would have to get a congressional mandate in order to start buying directly equities out of the system. This is something that people talk about a lot. It's like, oh, don't worry about it. Next financial crisis, they'll just start buying equities. Well, not without a congressional mandate. And that may be very, very hard to pass given the history of the of Congress's kind of animosity towards the Fed as it stands today, and particularly with Donald Trump in office currently. He's not a huge fan of the Federal Reserve, so it may be quite difficult for them to get a congressional mandate to allow them to start buying equities, which could put the Fed in a box in terms of the next financial crisis as to the length that they could go to try to bail out the markets. And this is why I believe that Janet Yellen understands, even though she was giving a speech earlier this week talking about how great the economy is doing and how employment's improved so much, I think she understands that really with the economy we're growing at less than 2%, we're barely meeting inflation goals, and the only reason we're meeting inflation goals is because of higher rent and higher health care costs for the most part, which is a drag on consumption because that goes right to the heart of disposable spending of individuals, but doesn't really leave a lot for increases in prices, which is what you need to create ultimately. Price inflation to lead to wage growth, et cetera, because you don't have the end demand on the other side by the consumer because they don't have any money. 80% of people have $500 in the bank. They're living on debt. Makes it very difficult for them to increase levels of consumption, which is why when we take a look at personal consumption expenditures, when we take a look at retail sales, they've remained primarily flat. So we haven't seen a huge increase in the amount of consumption and demand, which is also why economic growth rates remain sluggish. So tying all this together is that this is why I think the Fed is raising interest rates. I think they understand that we're closer to the next recession than not, and their worst fear is being caught at near zero interest rates and not having a policy tool available to help offset the drag of the next recession.
So you think that this hiking cycle is primarily driven by the need to create some room to ease, which you think is probably coming sooner than a lot of people think?
Yeah, absolutely. I believe that the Fed is in the process of hiking interest rates because just simply from the function, you and I mentioned this earlier, is that we're very long in the tooth of this current economic cycle. Economic cycles don't last forever. People say that economic cycles don't die of old age, but technically they do. There's generally a catalyst that we attribute to it at some point. It says, oh, well, had it not been for A, B, or C, then the economy wouldn't have been in a recession, but there is always a catalyst that comes along at a time. So we've had lots of catalysts over the last few years. We've had the emerging market issues. We've had Greece. We've had all these other things. Didn't push the economy into a recession because we were early in the stage of recovery and we're going through an economic recovery growth cycle. Consumption was picking up to some degree, inventory restocking cycles. There was enough economic growth to offset the drag that was occurring by these other events that were occurring around the world. But at some point, As the age of the economic cycle gets over, the ability gets older, the ability to withstand an economic exogenous shock from an economic or geopolitical event becomes less available. So at some point, we will have some trigger, and I would imagine within the next 12 to 18 months, that will trip the economy, if not sooner, into the next recessionary cycle. It's just a function of time, and we're very late in the cycle, and as we currently see now, economic growth rates are low, interest rates are coming up, you're starting to tighten monetary policy, and now the Fed's talking about reducing their balance sheet, which, by the way, I don't think will ever happen. But the reality is that we are likely much closer to a recession than that. I think Janet Yellen understands that, and her biggest fear, like I was saying, is getting caught with very little monetary policy at her disposal outside of QE. The best tool they have for offsetting recession is to lower interest rates and trying to spur consumption.
Well, and I agree with you completely, and I think that this announcement about shrinking the balance sheet is exactly the same thing as the hike that exists for the purpose of being able to ease later. I think that this comment about, you know, supposedly shrinking the balance sheet is being made now so that they can take it back later and be perceived as having done something positive.
Exactly.
Let's tie this all together in terms of the equity market. You know, if we look at all of this, I think you and I agree that this equity market has been fueled by what you might describe as some artificial artificial factors. But at the same time, I think we also agree that there's no real reason to conclude that it's necessarily over. So I think we probably also agree that a bear market is coming, but maybe not quite yet. What are the signals that you watch most closely? What are the things that tell you, okay, that's it, it's time to get short here, you know, this thing is just done?
I have a very dear friend of mine, Greg Morris. Greg Morris used to manage money for Stadium Mutual Funds. They were about a $4 billion fund company. He's also one of the guys behind StockCharts.com. Great technical analyst. Wrote some wonderful books on investing with a trend and some other things like that. Great reads. Anybody that needs to understand technical analysis, I certainly suggest they read Investing with a Trend by Greg Morris. It's a great primer to understanding the markets. He has a very simple philosophy. If the prices are going up, you stay long the market. If the prices are going down, you get out of the market or short the market. There's a very simple philosophy that as long as the markets are trending positively, in other words, you're in a bullish trend, you can either be long or neutral. That's it. Those are your only two choices in a bullish trending market. In a negatively trending market, you can only be neutral or short. You can't be long in a bearishly trending market. Now, the problem with this is how people define bulls and bears. Now, normally when you listen to the media, they say, well, you don't have a bear market until you drop 20%. I don't know about you, but I don't like losing 20% of my capital. So what I look for is looking for when the trend of the market is no longer, when the price trend of the market is no longer trending positively. So if you take a look at 50-day moving averages, what you can pick, you can draw directional trend lines, you can use moving averages, you know, pick your poison. It doesn't matter what you use. But as long as the general price trend is moving higher, I want to remain either long the market or I remain neutral from the market. And right now, as an example, we're very long the market, but we are holding a little bit of extra cash. Then we raised that cash. I wrote in my newsletter a couple of weeks ago that we were raising cash back in February heading into March because we suspected that there were some things that were going to occur, that healthcare was going to be a problem, and, of course, tax reform was going to be a bit of a problem. And so we raised some cash back then, expecting some sloppiness in the market. We've been long bonds since the beginning of this year. Once we got up to 2.6% on interest rates, we went long fixed income because of the rotation trade from risk to safety that we thought would occur. And that's exactly what's happened. Now, but I'm still long the market because nothing has violated that longer-term bullish trend at this point. Now, it may. And when it does, and we break some level of support that is important, and the directional trend of the market is no longer positive but now negative, I will either be cash or short the market in heavy bonds. Because in a market where asset prices are falling, people are going to seek a safe haven like U.S. Treasury. So it'll be a place to have some offset and make some income while we're waiting for a market to turn. This is the same philosophy we used back in 2008 to get out of the market, same thing we used back in 1999, 2000 to get out of the market. It's not complicated. It's not rocket science. It's not some black box thing. It's simply looking at a chart and saying, hey, guess what? Prices aren't going up anymore. Time to get out.
I want to come around to fixed income next, but before we go there, I want to focus on what's probably my favorite chart in the download that you sent us, which is on page 10, where you're talking about the economic deficit. And to me, what this chart is basically telling us is that a very well-known rule of central banking is that it's okay to have debt in the system, but the debt is not allowed to grow faster than the underlying economy. And, you know, when the European Union was formed, they created the Maastricht Treaty just to mandate that the individual countries would not be allowed to violate that basic rule of prudence that says when the grown-ups are in charge, you don't let the debt grow faster than the economy. And if I look at this chart, it just so beautifully illustrates that it looks like in the 80s sometime, early half of the 80s, the inmates took over the asylum. And I look at the scope of this economic deficit, and I say, wait a minute, how could this possibly have happened? And it makes me wonder, you know, how far does it get to? If I take the analogy of, you know, an individual, if somebody's got a little bit more debt than they should, well, they can get out of that. They can work it off. When you meet the guy who's a minimum wage guy who's got $84,000 in credit card debt because he somehow managed to con the credit card companies into giving him 27 cards that banks didn't know about all the other ones. Okay, that guy's walking dead. He's a zombie. He's going bankrupt. There's just no way around it. And I look at this chart and I'm saying, wow, Lance, you're really showing me a very compelling story that looks like it might be too late to get us out of this. And I don't think it's just sovereign debt. It's total debt in the economy is just way out of proportion to where it should be. So how does this possibly end well? Is it recoverable?
Sure. The problem is you just won't like the recovery. You know, take your example of the guy with $84,000 worth of credit card debt, and he makes $30,000 a year. He can get out of debt in a couple of manners, right? He can either file for bankruptcy, right? He can just default on his debt and walk away from everything, or he can take the approach of, hey, I'm going to pay it off. And in order to pay it off, what does he have to do at home, right? He's no longer doing anything at home. He's not going anywhere. He's eating rice and beans, and he's literally shoveling every piece of excess dollar scrap, et cetera, that he can find into paying off the debt. Of course, the lifestyle that he lives at that point is not great. And this is the same point that we're talking about here. You know, to your question, can we solve this $20 trillion in debt problem? I don't think anybody misunderstands that when you have $20 trillion in debt and you're growing and you've got debt at 105% of GDP, that there is a drag on the economic growth rate. And you know, people talk about, hey, we're going to get to 3 or 4% economic growth. No, we're not. Let me just be really clear. No, we're not. And the reason is that when you have debt, and not just governmental debt at $20 trillion, but now let's talk about Social Security and Medicare. There's another $40, $50 trillion of unfunded liability there that's got to be dealt with at some point. And then we talk about corporate leverage. We talk about margin debt, consumer household debt leverage, et cetera. We've got debt to an extent of which we have never seen before within the history of the United States. Well, the interesting the thing about debt, and just as with our example of the guy that's heavily leveraged at home with little income, the debt service requirements, just to keep your head above water, paying the minimum payment and the interest charge, eats up a lot of your ability of your disposable income to make ends meet. And this is what we see across America right now. People, you know, it's interesting because when we look at it, we talk about people have $500 in savings, and that's because they're paying house notes, credit card notes, they're paying car notes, they're paying student loan debt. They've got every bit of debt that they've got to meet those minimum payments, and their income levels haven't risen at a pace fast enough to offset the increases in the debt that they've taken on. And in fact, one of the interesting things that we talk about quite often is that if you take a look at retail sales, now, think about retail sales for just a second. The stuff we buy at Amazon and Target and Walmart, and in a lot of cases, this is stuff that you're not going out and buying a bunch of new stuff, right? You're not going out and buying new iPhones. You're not buying new stuff to play with or to live with. In a lot of cases, you're going out and you're spending money just to maintain your current standard of living. You're buying toilet paper and gasoline and food and these type of issues. And what we're seeing is we're seeing a ramp up in credit card debt. But we're not seeing a subsequent ramp up in the amount of retail sales. And what that tells you is that people are having to resort to using credit card debt in order just to maintain their standard of living, not increase their standard of living. And this is a dichotomy of something that we hadn't seen before. In the 80s and 90s, we increased debt, household debt, by about $12 trillion. But we saw a subsequent increase in the standard of living during that time. People were buying bigger houses and better cars and iPhones and computers and all this other stuff. But that level of debt increase has now continued up, but we're not seeing the same ramp up in consumption as a percentage of the overall economy. Now, remember, consumption today is about 70% of GDP. Back in the early 80s, it was closer to 60. So we've increased by a large amount the amount of consumption that makes up our economic growth rate. But today, we're not massively increasing that economic consumption as from the consumer side, but we're seeing a bigger increase in debt. So the problem now becomes back. That's a long way to answer your question. The only way you get out of this problem is that ultimately you've got to implement austerity. But nobody wants to do that. Nobody wants to give up Social Security. Nobody wants to give up Medicaid. Nobody wants to give up their government benefits. Nobody wants to give up their lifestyle. Nobody wants to cut back on spending. And this is why guys like Dave Ramsey have 80 million followers, because everybody's in debt at their eyeballs, and they're all looking for the get-out-of-jail-free card that isn't there.
Well, and I would make the argument that in a representative democracy, it is impossible to repay the debt for the reason that you just described, which is you're absolutely right. This could be done. You need a guy like Ron Paul to stand up and say, okay, folks, we've been irresponsible and reckless. We need to really tighten the belt here. We're going, you know, elect me, and I'm going to make sure that your standard of living goes down dramatically so that we can do the right thing for the country in the long term. Guess what? Ron Paul didn't get elected and never will. And anybody else who
just
tries
for that reason,
to...
by the way.
Yeah, exactly. And, you know, I think it was actually the right message, but there's no way that's ever going to play in a democracy. So I am concerned that we're at a point where we have this mountain of debt, which although theoretically it could be serviceable, I think it is unserviceable within our political system. And I wanted to just get that thought as a backdrop before I move into the next topic, which is the 35-year bond bull market. Treasuries, U.S. Treasury debt is at, I would say, artificially high price levels and artificially low interest rates designed intentionally by the Federal Reserve in order to achieve the goal of what I consider to be really remedying symptoms rather than the core problems that caused the financial crisis. So are we now at the point where the top is in, you know, 134 or whatever the low yield on the 10-year, was that it? Or if we come to another recession, is there going to be a last hurrah before the bond bull market is over and we start to see a secular return to historically normal interest rates?
Well, first of all, I'm not going to disagree with you, okay? But I have a different view, and this is what my wife says to me. She goes, I don't disagree, honey. I just have a different view. And that's her gentle way of saying I'm wrong. But, you know, that's okay. But the issue is simply that there's a different dynamic at play here. And if we and I will agree with you that if we were in a normal market environment and we had a normal demographic cycle and we had a normal situation within our economic growth and capacity and deficits and these type of things, I would agree with you that we would very likely be at or near the end of the great bond bull market. Now, let's talk about something. Going back to 1870, if we take a look at long-term interest rates, there have been two previous periods in history where we broke the long-term median interest rate of the 10-year Treasury. The first time that we broke that, it was 37 years before we got back to the median. The second time we broke it, it was 42 years before we got back to the median. Currently, right now, we're 7 years into the cycle. So just from that very standpoint alone, it could be another two decades before we get back to a median interest rate. But there's a difference between those previous two periods and today that make this potentially more of a situation that we are currently watching in another country. We've got a demographic issue. We currently have this massive group of baby boomers that are now moving out of the economic system and into retirement and eventually dying off. But as they move into retirement, they're now starting to extract capital from the markets. The other side of this coin is let's also remember what makes interest rates go up. Interest rates are a function of three factors: wage growth, inflationary pressures, and economic growth. And the reason that those three factors are critically important is because interest rates are a function of borrowing cost and inputs into a business. Let me explain. I'm a business, and I want to go out and I want to build a new facility. As a business owner, if I'm going to go out and make a capital expenditure and I'm going to borrow the money to go make that capital expenditure, if my borrowing cost is 5%, just as an example, and I look at the profitability of my venture and my venture is going to yield a 7% annual rate of return, then I will borrow the money at 5% and I will go out and do my facility at 7% and I'll collect a 2% spread until my debt's paid off and then I'm good to go. Well, what I need to make sure and always be on the positive side of that, and if you go back and look at the 1940s, 50s, and 60s, and 70s, as we came back from World War II and we began to rebuild the global economy, remember, after World War II, we'd bombed everything out. Russia was bombed out. Germany was bombed out. Everybody was bombed out. Japan was bombed out. The United States was the manufacturing epicenter of the entire world. And so as our soldiers came back home, we had all this pent-up demand following the war. That helped kind of launch the economy. But then we were manufacturing everything. And in manufacturing, when we manufacture stuff, if we go out and we build a train or we go out and build a television or we build a telephone or whatever it is, that has a much higher flow through within the economy. It's called the multiplier effect. In other words, every dollar I spend on building a piece of equipment yields $4 or $5 within the economy versus an Uber ride, which in terms of a service sector type product may only yield a dollar, has a much lower multiplier effect. So services, a service-based industry, has a much lower growth rate than a manufacturing capacity. And if you go back and look at the 60s and 70s, interest rates were rising and we had, you know, 10, 11, 12, 13, 14% interest rates, but the economy was growing at 5, 6, 7, 8 times 8% a year. We had a very high economic growth rate. Wages were rising. People had more money to spend. And because wages were going up, and by the way, household debt was about 60% of net worth at that point in time. So the household balance sheet was in very, very good shape. So as interest rates went up, businesses could afford the higher borrowing costs. They could borrow money and still sell their products at a higher price to the consumer, which was not heavily leveraged, so they had lots of liquidity and saving. Savings rates were rising. In other words, you had all the factors available to lift interest rates and allow interest rates to go up because inflationary pressures were rising, and inflationary pressures were rising because businesses could charge more for the products, goods, and services they were providing, and consumers could afford the higher prices because their wages were going up. So that's the math. Now, what have we not had? Now, you pointed out that you caught the look on that graph, that economic deficit graph. You caught the year, 1983. What happened in 1983 that was so critical and important? Ronald Reagan takes office, and I'm going to argue that I think Paul Volcker might have made a mistake. Paul Volcker comes in with Ronald Reagan. I say, we have to break the back of this inflation and interest rates. I had a client that actually bought 30-year treasuries back in 1983 and just sat on them for 20 years, collected the coupons, made a killing. But people argue that he had to come in and break the back of inflation and interest rates, but when he did that, we have now seen, and of course Ronald Reagan, you know, deregulated the financial sector, which allowed banks to start issuing out credit like crazy. So a couple of things happened. First of all, the household debt to net worth ratio soared to 140% by 2000. Economic growth rates went from 8% to 4%. Inflation fell from 14% to 5% by 2000. Interest rates fell from 10, 11, 12, 13% down to 5% by 2000. In other words, everything started going in reverse. Wages fell. Wages have been falling. The growth rate of wages have been declining for the last 30 years. The growth rate of the economy has been declining. And so in order to offset declining wage growth, declining inflation, declining economic growth, declining and declining ability to maintain a standard of living, consumers have had to resort to debt to maintain their standard of living that they've wanted. So, you know, we're the only country in the world where poor people live in a three-bedroom house with a swimming pool. So today the problem here is you want higher interest rates, but you don't have any ability to foster the type of economic environment that you need to sustain higher rates. So now when rates go up, it immediately impacts consumption, which immediately slows the economy, which immediately draws interest rates back lower. What country sounds like this? Japan. They've got the same demographic problem. They've got the same pension problem as we have with Social Security and Medicare. And they've got the same consumption problem. So you take a look at Japan. They've been locked at low interest rates for 30 years. I think there's a real possibility, like I said before, interest rates can remain low for a very long period of time, and we're very early in the cycle. So while we may not be at the beginning of a new bond bull market, we're probably not in the new bond bear market either. We may be in a bond stable market where interest rates remain between 1% and 2% for the next 10 years.
And what does that mean in terms of the economy's ability to operate if you're not rewarding capital for investment? You know, there's a lot of consequences to being in a low interest rate environment. Is it just economic stagnation? Where does that take the real economy?
Economic stagnation. And that's really the easiest way to look at it, is that we may be in an environment where we see 2% economic growth as being the high watermark. And it's also, ironically, what the Fed's predicting. It's also what the CBO's predicting for the next decade. So, again, when you take a look at all these factors, and particularly when you look at the fact that millennials are coming up, they're moving into a society where they're more urbanized, they are looking for issues where they are more service-oriented than ever before, they have a they today millennials make the same wage. Actually, they make less wages than what their counterparts were making 20 years ago. So there's an inability to spark the type of economic growth that we need to reach those 3% and 4% levels. So there's, you know, when you line up the demographic factors with the financial factors and the debt factors, it suggests, I'm not saying this is absolutely going to be the case, and maybe, hopefully, I would love for you to come back to me in a year or two and say, see, you were totally wrong. We're at 4% growth. I just can't figure out mathematically, when you put 2 plus 2 together, how you get to 4. Because we just don't have the dynamics available currently to get there. So that suggests that we're going to be in a range of economic growth between this, kind of a recession type area to 2%, and interest rates will probably remain somewhere between 0 and 2, 2.5% for a very long period of time. And by the way, with the next recession, we'll probably see interest rates get back down to, you know, closer to zero.
Before we close, I'd like to move on to a topic that's near and dear to many of our listeners' hearts, which is precious metals. In this environment that we've been discussing, this massive debt overload that is facing the economy, you know, the gold bugs would tell you the only place to be is, you know, levered up a zillion percent into precious metals. And right. At the same time, we also have the very well-framed argument that a lot of people are saying, look, whether Donald Trump likes a strong dollar or not, his policies are very dollar bullish, and that can only be gold and silver bearish. So how do you see this? What's your outlook for precious metals?
So let me qualify by saying that I'm not the guy that's sitting on a big bunker full of gold at my house. I have a big bunker full of lead because I figure that in a worst-case scenario, if I get into an environment where I need to go get gold, I would rather have guns and bullets to go acquire that with rather than be the guy sitting there without them and having the gold. Because when you're talking about owning gold as a measure against economic devastation and talking about going back to where you're bartering on gold, that's a really, really bad economic event. And I prefer not to think that I prefer to think that as Americans and as a country that we will avoid dragging ourselves into that position. I figure I hope that as Americans and as individuals, we will come to our senses sooner than later and take action. Most of the time, the most dire economic consequences that we can imagine don't come to fruition because Americans tend to wake up and say, hey, enough is enough. I need to make changes. But it gets pretty bad before you get there. So I'm not the guy that has a bunch of gold in my house, and probably people will chastise me for that, and that's okay. It's personal preference. In portfolios, from a portfolio management perspective, we do own gold, and we own gold from time to time. In 2010 to 2013, we owned a lot of gold in our portfolio, and it performed very well. And 2013, we actually got out of gold entirely, and we've remained out of gold ever since that period of time. And during this entire sliding gold. And that's simply, again, as we were talking about earlier with the stock market, right? The trend in gold is not bullish. The trend in gold is very bearish. And when the trend in gold is bearish or the trend in stocks is bearish, I can only be what? Two things. I can either be neutral or short. Right now I'm neutral gold because the trend is bearish. However, let me say this, that there are signs that we may be in the early changes of that trend in gold becoming more bullish. And if it does, I'll be adding gold back into our portfolios. I don't have any problem whatsoever with people that want to own gold or own gold coins, you know, in their lockers, in their bunkers, whatever they've got. That's completely okay. I wouldn't dress as a portfolio manager, as with anything, I would never overweight all my assets into one asset class, and particularly one that's potentially illiquid. Let me just warn you about one thing. If we ever get to the point that the markets do heal themselves up and we get back into, and we will eventually, we're going to have another big bear market. We're probably going to lose between 30 and 50% in the next bear market whenever it occurs. At that point, though, I will suggest that we are going to be very much back to a 1974, what we call a black bear market. In 1974, when we hit the bottom of the bear market, nobody wanted to own equities. People did not come back to the equity market until 1990, for the most part. You wipe people out. People were done with it. And you had this massive negative sentiment on the stock market. I think we will get there on the third wipeout of individuals' retirement plans. That's going to be the opportunity to where ultimately we want to buy equities for the long term, quote. And people talk about buying equities for the long term. I think that's your opportunity. You'll be buying cheap valuations of good quality companies. But back, as you saw in the early 80s, you know, gold prices were very high back in the 70s. And then once you begin this secular bull market that began in the 80s, gold prices dropped and they continued to drop to very low levels. There'll be a point where we will get to that position again. And when it comes time for you to sell your gold and you've got physical holdings and you get down to the place to sell your gold, there's going to be a line wrapped around the building and the prices are going to be plummeting while you're trying to dump your physical gold. So for me, this is why I go back to owning gold in a liquid form as a portfolio manager, so I can get in it and out of it when I need to without incurring a lot of costs. Again, it's a personal preference. Whatever people choose to do, that's up to them. I'm just not a giant gold bug.
Well, this is a fantastic interview. I really appreciate it. Unfortunately, we are out of time. But before we close, I just want to touch on so many different ways that our listeners can follow your work, because I know a lot of them are going to want to. You're very, very popular in your articles that are published on Zero Hedge. You also have your own podcast. You were kind enough to invite me to be a guest on it next week, so I'm looking forward to that. First of all, where do our listeners find out about the podcast?
The podcasts are on our website, realinvestmentadvice.com. It's under the media tab. We both list our podcast on the site as well as to SoundCloud. So if you have a SoundCloud app on your phone, you can actually drag down the podcast from the Real Investment Hour onto your phone from that as well. But of course, at the website, realinvestmentadvice.com, we also have our daily blog posts. We've got a weekly newsletter. You know, everything is there.
Okay. And what do you actually do at Clarity Financial? Let's cover that as well.
I am the chief investment strategist and portfolio manager at Clarity Financial. My job is basically I build and run portfolios for individual clients, mostly high net worth investors and mostly primarily retirees, people that are moving into retirement, and capital preservation is a much bigger issue. In my portfolios, you won't find Tesla, you won't find Snap, because valuations are a key driver of those portfolios, and capital preservation is a big thing. So interest rates and bonds, these are very, very key critical factors for our clients, and we build portfolios around that.
Okay, so investment advisor primarily to high net worth, and that's at Clarity Financial, and realinvestmentadvice.com is your retail website where you have the blog as well as the podcasts. So that is absolutely fantastic. We sure appreciate it, and I look forward to being on your show and turning the tables next week. Patrick Ceresna and I will be back as Macro Voices continues right here at macrovoices.com.
Macro Voices is a listener-driven program. Please email requests for specific future interview guests to requests@macrovoices.com. You can email questions for the program to mailbag@macrovoices.com, and we'll answer them on the air from time to time in our mailbag segment. We also welcome your suggestions for how we can improve the program. Now, back to your hosts, Eric Townsend and Patrick Ceresna.
Eric, what a great interview with Lance. I always really enjoy listening to our guests that talk about liquidity, because I find liquidity such an important factor in where the market goes next. And he really put together some really interesting charts on that. What were your thoughts on the interview?
You know, the thing that stood out for me was, although it's an old lesson, it's a very, very important one. When Lance so succinctly explained, when the market major trend is up, which it is right now, your choices are to be long or to be out. It doesn't make sense to be short here. And it's a good reminder to me, because I see so many reasons that this market should not be at these valuation levels. It's tempting to want to go to short. You know, you can't do that, because the trend is your friend and the trend is up, as much as it doesn't make sense to me. Now, for the last several months, Patrick, we've focused many of these post-game segments on the topic of using option writing as an asset class. We extensively covered the topic, discussing everything from covered call writing to selling puts, call and put spreads and short straddles and strangles. There's one last strategy, though, that we wanted to discuss, and that was iron condors and iron butterflies. Now, Patrick, I just saw the movie Avatar, and I think those were iron condors that the aliens were riding in that final scene. So why don't you give our listeners a quick rundown on this strategy, starting with these crazy names?
Yeah, I find it a little humorous, all these outlandish names options traders give these option combinations, which to a beginner makes it appear very overwhelming. But when you break down the strategy, it becomes far easier to understand. In the case of the iron butterfly, it structurally has all the same characteristics of the short straddle that we discussed last week. So you would open the short butterfly for the exact same fundamental and technical reasons. So what makes it different? With the short straddle, you are naked a short call option and naked a short put option. Basically, you have these big undefined tail risks on the outlier moves in the market. But with the short butterfly, what you're doing is the same strategy, but rather than opening this as a naked position on either leg, you're rather opening a call credit spread and simultaneously opening a put credit spread. So what makes an iron butterfly a butterfly is that the short call and the short put within the spreads are straddled on a specific price point for that maximum profitability, creating that V-shape to the chart pattern.
You mentioned the V-shape. We should probably explain that where these crazy names actually come from is drawing the risk-return profile on a chart. The shape of that risk-return profile sort of kind of a little bit looks like a butterfly or a condor, although I think, as you say, that they're stretching these the creativity that goes into some of these names. So this sounds like a much more captivating strategy to me than the short straddle. One of the reasons that I was so negative on the idea of short straddles when we talked about it last week was I think the stock market could potentially have a big move in either direction here. Now, if you're using a short butterfly, you could contain those tail risks, and that would give me a little bit more confidence in this strategy.
That's right. So when opening the wings of this options combination as a credit spread, you've defined your maximum risk. Now, so to move on to the next variation, when you look at compare the iron butterfly to the iron condor, they literally are the same strategy, but the butterfly is straddling one specific price, and the condor, you simply are widening apart the two credit spreads to create a target zone versus a target price.
Okay, so in other words, the butterfly is to the straddle as the condor is to a strangle. I think, though, that the best way to approach this is going to be with an example.
Right, so let's build a hypothetical scenario with a stock like Apple using an iron condor. Now, Apple's shares hit a high of $145 last week and has now pulled back since, now trading around $142. So let's say our trader feels that Apple has finished this rally and it is unlikely to go much higher, but at the same time believes that most of the sell-offs will be very shallow and likely to find quick support. And so the outlook here has to be one that Apple's going to be range-bound from its outcome perspective. And so our trader opens a June expiration $10 wide credit spread between, let's say, $145 and $155 strikes on Apple. In addition, the trader opens a June expiration $10 wide put credit spread, and let's say between the $135 to $125 strikes. So the combination together creates a credit income of somewhere just under $4.
Now, to be clear for our listeners, that also means that you're basically creating a sweet spot for maximum profitability, which occurs if Apple closes within that range between $135 and $145.
Exactly. Now, traders can adjust this space, this $10 zone, higher or lower based upon their forecasts or expectations. And while there is a $10 sweet spot, I do want to stress that the trader's profit zone actually lies between $131 to $149, almost a $20 range. So long as you can pick a stock where you think there's a very high probability that the stock will stay within that zone, you can just sit back and see how it plays out.
Well, that sounds good. I like before I sit back and do anything to understand my risk first. So this strategy basically has the same characteristics of the straddle or strangle in that only one of those spreads could be a loss because the market can't go two directions at once. The other one is guaranteed to be 100% profit. So we need to focus on how much we could lose on the one that could be a loss. And in this case, with a $10 spread, that's our downside risk, but we've got a $4 credit, which is what we made, it sounds like we got $4 of profit potential and a maximum risk of $6. So that's a pretty good ratio. I feel a lot better about that strategy than the unlimited loss that could theoretically occur in the short straddle or strangle.
Well, exactly. That is the appeal to the trader doing this strategy. Condors and butterflies over that of doing straddles and strangles. The first point is that the maximum loss can only be reached on expiration date. So if there's a major move in Apple, either way, higher or lower, let's say we're out to June and in the middle of May, it makes this really big move, the trader can usually cut out of the position at a much smaller loss early rather than realizing a full $6 risk. This is also a really neat strategy because many stocks spend extended periods of time range bound consolidating versus trending, so traders can sit back and harvest profits consistently, and eventually when the stock breaks out, the trader just cuts out of the trade and takes a quick loss and then moves on to another candidate.
Okay, so how does this fit into your overarching theme we've been talking about for the last several weeks of option writing as an asset class in a portfolio?
Well, very similar to like we discussed last week, the money managers that apply this strategy to their portfolios do so usually because they have a very large exposure to equities. And so they use this as a complementary strategy to generate income on there. So by having a component allocated to iron condors or butterflies, you are creating an alternative return for when equities are doing little or nothing. So in a flat market, there's additional returns beyond that just of getting dividends.
Patrick, we've gotten a lot of positive feedback on this series of post-game segments where essentially you've been talking about option writing as an asset class, giving our listeners a little tasting, if you will, of some of the types of strategies that you teach at BigPictureTrading.com in your option class. But options trading is just one of the topics that you teach. And frankly, I think we've given that subject pretty thorough coverage at this point. So for our next few episodes, why don't we plan to keep the series of mini tutorials going, but shift from option writing to something else? So what else do you have up your sleeve?
Well, since this is Macro Voices, why don't we continue the tutorial series with some sample lessons on some of our Macro Masters course?
Okay, and the Macro Masters course, of course, is your macro-driven fundamental analysis course that you offer at BigPictureTrading.com. And folks, if you want to learn more about this, Patrick is a fantastic instructor and mentor, and he is in the business of teaching people how to trade. His website is BigPictureTrading.com. You can learn more there. And meanwhile, keep your questions and topic suggestions coming for Macro Voices. You can send those via email to requests@macrovoices.com. And we still need your help promoting the show, so please retweet us, tell your friends about Macro Voices, forward your research roundup emails, use our new player embed so you can put a Macro Voices player on your website, and most importantly, please register your free account at macrovoices.com. We won't spam you with any advertising. All that you're going to get is a benefit to you, which is the Research Roundup email, which is a compendium of links both to the content provided by our feature interview guests, as well as all the cool free stuff that we could find each week. Patrick, what's in this week's Research Roundup?
So what our members will find in there is a transcript for today's interview with Lance Roberts. In addition, obviously, the link to the chart book that accompanied this week's interview. In addition to that, I included a link for an article by Jeffrey Snyder titled The Global Burden. As well, there's a great Macro Risk Advisors article titled Financial Insurance is Not Like Hurricane Insurance. And the last article I wanted to just point out was a David Rosenberg piece that was done in the Financial Post saying, make no mistake, the Toronto real estate market is in a bubble of historic proportions. So you'll find this and so much more in this week's Research Roundup. So that does it for this week's episode. We appreciate all the feedback and support we get from our listeners and are always looking for suggestions on how we can make the program even better. For those of our listeners that write or blog about the markets and would like to share that content with our listeners, send us an email at researchroundup@macrovoices.com or tag it with the MVRR hashtag on Twitter, and we'll include it in our weekly distributions. If you have not already, follow our main Twitter account, @MacroVoices, for all the most recent updates and releases. You can also follow Eric on Twitter, @EricSTownsend. On behalf of Eric Townsend and myself, thank you for listening, and see you all next week.
That concludes this edition of Macro Voices. Be sure to tune in each week to hear feature interviews with the brightest minds in finance and macroeconomics. Macro Voices is made possible by sponsorship from BigPictureTrading.com, the Internet's premier source of online education for traders. Please visit BigPictureTrading.com for more information. Please register your free account at MacroVoices.com. Once registered, you'll receive our free weekly Research Roundup email containing links to supporting documents from our featured guests and the very best free financial content our volunteer research team could find on the Internet each week. You'll also gain access to our free listener discussion forums and research library. And the more registered users we have, the more we'll be able to recruit high-profile feature interview guests for future programs. So please register your free account today at macrovoices.com if you haven't already. You can subscribe to Macro Voices on iTunes to have Macro Voices automatically delivered to your mobile device each week free of charge. You can email questions for the program to mailbag@macrovoices.com, and we'll answer your questions on the air from time to time in our mailbag segment. Macro Voices is presented for informational and entertainment purposes only. The information presented on Macro Voices should not be construed as investment advice. Always consult a licensed investment professional before making investment decisions. The views and opinions expressed on Macro Voices are those of the participants and do not necessarily reflect those of the show's hosts or sponsors. Macro Voices, its producers, sponsors, and hosts Eric Townsend and Patrick Ceresna shall not be liable for losses resulting from investment decisions based on information or viewpoints presented on Macro Voices. Macro Voices is made possible by sponsorship from BigPictureTrading.com and by funding from Fourth Turning Capital Management, LLC. For more information, visit MacroVoices.com.